Welcome to Let's Hear It.
Let's Hear It is a podcast for and about the field of foundation and nonprofit communications, produced by its two co-hosts, Eric Brown and Kirk Brown. No relation.
Well said, Eric. And I'm Kirk.
And I'm Eric. The podcast is sponsored by the College Futures Foundation, which envisions a California where post-secondary education advances equity and unlocks upward mobility now and for generations to come. To learn more, visit collegefutures.org.
You can find Let's Hear It on any podcast subscription platform.
You can find us online at letshearitcast.com. You can find us on LinkedIn and, yes, even on Instagram.
And if you like the show, please, please, please rate us on Apple Podcasts so that more people can find us.
So let's get on to the show.
Welcome in, gather around, welcome back. It's another episode of Let's Hear It. We're glad to have you, glad to be here.
Are you going to make s'mores?
I did the welcome in. You're
gonna
all make for you, Mr. Brown.
You're gathering around, you're going to make s'mores?
We're gathering, we're lighting the fire, we're saying, come on in. We have a great conversation ahead, and this is consequential. This is so consequential. And in fact, it's let's just leave it at consequential. This is a very important discussion we're about to hear. Let's set it up, Eric, and then we will listen and we'll come back. There's a lot to talk about.
My mother would say there will be consequences.
Very consequential.
I sat down in the flesh in the same room, which is very exciting. We don't always do it this way. With Don Howard, who is the president and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation, which is a California-wide grant-making institution of great note, and Elena Chavez Quesada, who is senior advisor for social innovation in the office of Governor Gavin Newsom of the great state of California.
So you've got some big time. This is the other way we're going to say
it. These are big time guests.
This is big time stuff.
President of the foundation and the right hand of the governor on social innovation. How about that? And so the conversation was about partnerships between foundations and government. And Elena and Don had recently co-written a piece for the Candid website about this very topic. And I saw that and I'm like, wow, I know both of these people. This is amazing. I've been thinking about this stuff since I was in knee pants. And I would love to talk to them and have a conversation about how can foundations and governments work together to make the world a better place.
So the piece by Elena and Don is called How Philanthropy Can Partner with the Public Sector to Build Equitable Infrastructure. And that ran on Candid on November 1st. And yeah, this is a conversation of incredible consequence. I'll save my first comments for it when we come back. So this is Don Howard, President and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation, and Elena Chavez Quesada from Governor Newsom's Office of Social Innovation. Let's listen and we'll be back.
Welcome to Let's Hear It. My guests today are Elena Chavez Quesada, Senior Advisor for Social Innovation in the Office of Governor Gavin Newsom, and Don Howard, the President and CEO at the James Irvine Foundation. Two people that I really, really like a lot, and I'm so happy that you would join us for this great conversation. Thank you so much for coming on to Let's Hear It.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so let's just dive right in here. You recently published an article on the Candid website that was called How Philanthropy Can Partner with the Public Sector to Build Equitable Infrastructure. Okay, first of all, this notion of philanthropy and government working together is very exciting. I was a press secretary for a year. As I said earlier, I've been trading on that year for a really long time. And when I came into philanthropy, I always thought to myself, why government and philanthropy should work together because we, you know, philanthropy can take risks and government has money and it doesn't seem to happen that much. I've always felt like there was a huge missed opportunity. So when you wrote this article, I was like, oh, wow, this is a great conversation. And I know these people, so maybe we can have a great conversation about it. And so maybe I'll just start with you, Elena. Why was this an important topic for you to write about? No, I will also go back and say that you worked at the San Francisco Foundation. That's where we know each other. And you've worked in the nonprofit world. And now you've gone over into the other side. So tell me about why this was a good story to tell and why you wanted to participate in this kind of conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. And I think this is exactly the kind of conversation that gets me excited in the morning. I do want to start out by saying fundamentally, in Governor Newsom's office, we believe in partnership. So we have, there is a certain degree of humility that I find quite refreshing to say we can't do it alone. Even in a state with the fifth largest economy in the world, even when our budget kind of dwarfs philanthropic dollars, there's a lot that we can learn from and partner with philanthropy on. So that's part of why I was so excited to write this piece. There's a few things that I think philanthropy does really well that the state can't do and vice versa. Scale is one of them. So the state can put out big dollars at scale, and there's a lot of infrastructure work happening across the state. Philanthropy can help us make sure it's implemented well. Risk is the other one that you alluded to. So there's massive dollars, but we might want to innovate. We might want to try out different models of like, how does this actually work on the ground in a way that's responsive to the community? So philanthropy can help us take some of those risks. There's also time. So we are time limited in the government, and so philanthropy will still be there. So I think when it comes to infrastructure, these are the massive dollars, massive opportunity, and we need to make sure that communities who have always been left out of those tables and haven't had the capacity really have the opportunity to benefit from these infrastructure dollars and make sure it's implemented well in their communities. So that's what prompted me to be so excited to write this piece with Don and just talk more about what that looks like.
Following up on that, Don, what do you think that your foundation colleagues could get out of this piece? What do they need to learn about partnering with government?
Well, first, I'd say partnership is possible, but it is dependent on the conditions being correct. We've been trying to partner for a long time, and it was with Elena and her predecessor where partnerships were actually possible to do. We have a ton of values alignment, and the administration is very open to having partnerships. So we've been able to really engage in a way we haven't been able to engage before.
So you're saying conditions being correct. Can you give us a little more on that?
Well, like I said, values alignment in the first place, but also a willingness to open the door, be authentic, find ways to trust one another, and to pilot things and build from there. In past administrations, we haven't had the door open. And I think the point person that Elena's providing, the role she's providing in the governor's team, is a unique one and one that really allows us to tap in a relationship-based way that's trust-based and that we didn't have before.
Elena, Don was talking about the door not being open in past administrations. Now, the previous administration was also a Democrat who, in theory, was in a high alignment with some of what these many foundations are trying to do, and yet things didn't happen. Here you go. You get a chance to say something nice about your boss, but can you talk about how the governor's office wanted to open that door or kind of give us a sense of what that means to have a door open to philanthropy?
Well, I think at the kind of highest level, it's about building that trusting relationship that Don mentioned. So it does take a certain amount of vulnerability, I would say, for the state to say, here's what we're really excited about and here's what we're struggling with. And so I think that level of authentic conversation with philanthropy to say, like, we need help kind of figuring this out. And also, it's a push and pull, right? Like, I know philanthropy can have strong opinions about what the state is or is not doing. But if we don't have a forum to have that conversation, if you don't have a person, which I'm that person for philanthropy to help connect to different state leaders, I can hear it myself, I can bring in the right people, we will never have that push and pull. So I think, and I think there's a lot of lack of understanding of like what the state can and cannot do. And same in the nonprofit sector and the groups that philanthropy works with. The other thing is that when I talked earlier about scale, the state puts out big dollars at scale, but like it can be clunky in implementation. We're a big, big state with like super diverse regions, and we have funders who have built their entire expertise on like getting to know those regions and doing right by them. And so I think that's another big opportunity for the state and philanthropy to partner together. And that's what like a relationship means, is we've got the big picture and we're values aligned on that big picture. But the proof is in the pudding. Like, it's all about how it's implemented. And I think we all sometimes get distracted by like the big policy win and not necessarily the implementation of it. That's where we need that open line to philanthropy. So I'm constantly trying to say, where does the governor's priorities and philanthropy's priorities intersect? Where are those kind of magical moments where we can align our resources to impact, to have an outsized impact.
Well, you mentioned these magical moments. Now, a couple of magical moments happened in the last year or so, a couple of really large infrastructure spending bills. And you focus on this in your piece. There was the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which everybody keeps saying IIJA, and I have no idea what they're talking about. And then there was the interestingly named Inflation Reduction Act. So both of these are pumping a ton of money into states and into communities. And there's in both of them, there are identified opportunities for communities that have been left out of the opportunity that federal funding has been able to offer in the past. So this feels like in the pre-interview, we were talking, Don, about the moment, these brief moments when things can come along, call it a window of opportunity. It feels like that window is cracked just a bit, and that you are talking about how do we use this combined power and influence to be able to access those funds and make them work well. So Don, can you kind of give us a little bit more on like what is this money and how do you see it providing opportunity?
It certainly is a window of opportunity, and I don't think it'll shut quickly. I think we're at a position in time where we have to remake our economies for climate resilience and for equity. And we can see vicissitudes in sort of the political process, but this isn't going to be the first, or it can't be the first if we really want to see our climate restored and see our communities have real economic inclusion. So that's the thing. I also don't want you to forget the state is putting a ton of money into infrastructure and climate. So best estimates we've seen are somewhere between $90 and $120 billion are coming into California. And those dollars can be used to either catalyze real opportunity in communities, or they can kind of instantiate the powers as they are today and benefit the few rather than the many. So we as philanthropy see this, particularly Irvine. Our North Star is ensuring that every low-income worker has the power to advance economically. And this is a chance to recreate pathways to the middle class, this time hopefully for everyone. And we've been able to support communities to help them be real players and have their voices heard in how these dollars are used. They could either be used to recreate what we currently have, or if the community's priorities are taken into account, better jobs, good areas of economic development, and real inclusion at the table of decision makers can result from that. So that's what we've been providing support for. And then comes along the public funding, and we see, wow, this capacity we've been supporting in communities can now have a chance to really direct these resources. And there's risks. So one of them is the money is coming faster than communities can get prepared for. And that's by dint of a lot of different circumstances, not the least of which is the political cycles. And the money's also coming in so many different programmatic areas, each of which has some community engagement, that effectively it's kind of no community engagement. If you ask someone to go to 30 town halls, and how are they going to do that? One thing we've done with other philanthropies, which I think is notable, is create a sort of pooled fund called the Community Economic Mobilization Initiative. And that's been re-granting dollars to grassroots and community organizations so they can add a person, or they can think about which of those town halls to go to, or they can be better, have better capacity to sit at the table and say, no, these are the economics of our community, and can stand up, frankly, to folks who might be the traditional winners in those economic decisions.
So it sounds, since this is nominally a show about communications, it sounds like communications is fairly important in this regard, because needless to say, Elena has kind of tried and figure out how to sift and sort through all the information and kind of also understand what the narrative is, frankly, about why this matters and how it gets done. Elena, can you talk a little bit about how you are kind of getting all that information and what you do with it and what various factors come into play as you try to decide which projects to advance, how to build these kinds of partnerships, and so on?
Well, I think having an equity lens is super important, and want to really highlight the governor's commitment to equity through an executive order that we did last year. And there's all kinds of ways that this can look like. The executive order on equity is really looking at how the state can do a better job through our internal systems, through our communications and processes. So if you take that lens, and we have all of these federal dollars and state dollars flowing, who's best positioned to get those dollars? The people who already have dollars. And so an equity lens requires us to say who really has all of the planning and has done a lot of organizing, knows what their community needs and wants, but doesn't have the capacity to go after those dollars. That's how I really think about prioritizing, because these regions of the state are not all starting from the same place. So when I'm trying to sift through, you know, all of the opportunities and ways that the governor's office and philanthropy could work together, it's ensuring that some regions have an equal starting place.
That's an example of values alignment. That's very much how we see our role in supporting communities, with an equity lens, ensuring that folks that often been overlooked, particularly folks who aren't white workers, quite frankly, aren't getting their fair share of the spoils. So that's a very clear value for us. And I know it's a clear value for the administration. And it's a place we can partner. We're in relationship with a lot of these groups that are often overlooked. And we can bring those groups to the table and we can help them be in better relationship with their local civic leaders, but also with the state.
Well, I think that's part of the beauty of having you inside, I'm looking at Atlanta, at having you inside government, because you understand foundations and you understand community foundations and you understand the grantees. And so you have this real sense. I assume.
Thank you.
But I know it's true. But you have the sense what organizations, how they could use the money, how they operate. And you just have this view into all you've been in the belly of all the beasts now. Now, is this a new position? I mean, how has this state built these relationships over time? And what kind of infrastructure are you building in the governor's office to be able to do this over time? Because I think that those kinds of relationships are so important, but they're based on people and their own experience.
Yeah, so this position is new to the Newsom administration. So when the governor got elected, it was very clear that prioritizing relationships with philanthropy and moving public-private partnerships was important. So my predecessor, Kathleen Kelly Janis, was the first one to have this position. And it is a lot of external work. Foundations are not an ATM. It's about building these relationships. There are dollars at play here, and I think the state has very restrictive dollars. It has inflexible dollars. It has dollars that take a really long time to get out. And so these are all things that we can partner with philanthropy on. It's not just about the transaction. It's really about like a trusting relationship, being able to share feedback, being able to share concerns and kind of connect the dots. One way that we kind of build this infrastructure into the government is I sit on the cabinet affairs team and work very closely with my colleagues. So there's no project that I do that is something that I, Elena, think is a good idea. It is really something that my colleagues have said, this is a governor's priority, we're working on this. And they are front and center with philanthropy in helping to kind of understand the context and share all the details. So I am very much a generalist. The other way that I think is really smart that we started to embed into government is I have liaisons at almost every agency. So we have public-private partnership liaisons who have really busy jobs as, you know, deputy secretaries or senior advisors or whatever their role is within their respective agencies. But public-private partnerships is part of their portfolio. We convene them monthly, and we have a bit of a learning community. And so we're constantly exchanging ideas. Part of it is I am here to support agencies and building that muscle. The other part of it is it's really important for me in the governor's office to have an understanding of all the ways that the state is engaging with philanthropy so that we're strategic and we're coordinated.
And Elena's role has been really consequential, the position that was created, because from a philanthropy perspective, we can't engage with every agency. It's just, you know, unreasonable, and we don't have the sort of capacity or resources, and it wouldn't get done. Our focus on low-income workers is also allows us to think more kind of intersectionally with the agencies that affect people's lives. And Elena can coordinate that. The fact that we can then call Elena and say, hey, how can we get involved in this program? Let's just take California Jobs first. We can tie in. We've been supporting communities to organize around inclusive economic growth, kind of just transition planning from the region up. And the state basically took the model and brought it to scale with California Jobs First. So we can then reach out to Elena and say, okay, how do we coordinate our investments in a place like the Inland Empire with what the state's trying to do? And then the dollars that might not be so flexible coming from the state, we can kind of provide glue around it. We can help folks plan. We can help folks evaluate. We can provide funding, frankly, for things that are as consequential as having childcare at a community meeting. Those are not the kinds of things that government funding can typically be used for, but it's huge leverage for us if the decision is being made around, you know, a $50 million grant for a particular project. If we can support the community engagement piece of that, that's a huge amount of leverage for philanthropic dollars.
Well, we're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Elena Chavez-Quesada, the Senior Advisor for Social Innovation at the Office of Governor Gavin Newsom, and Don Howard, President and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation.
You're listening to Let's Hear It, a podcast about foundation and nonprofit communications hosted by Eric Brown and Kirk Brown. If you're enjoying this episode, you may just be a rule breaker. Tune in to Break Fake Rules, a new limited series podcast with Glenn Galich, CEO of the Stupski Foundation. Hear from leaders in philanthropy, nonprofits, government, media, and more to learn about challenges they've overcome by breaking fake rules and which rules we should commit to breaking together. We are also sponsored by the Conrad Prebys Foundation. Check out their amazingly good podcast, and we're not just saying that, Stop and Talk, hosted by Prebys Foundation CEO Grant Oliphant. You can find them at stopandtalkpodcast.com. And now, back to the show.
And we are back with Elena Chavez-Quesada and Don Howard, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. So now, this is my favorite question that I've been thinking about, Don, because when I was head of comms at Hewlett, I sometimes had to practice law without a license because much of what we were doing was advocacy. We're trying to move systems. And so in your piece, you have a quote here that I got very excited about. You say, you call on funders to support, quote, advocating for state funds that enable community-led economic planning, unquote. So like foundations go screaming for the exits. The general counsel will come banging on your door and wrestle you to the ground and hogtie you and take you out. So can you talk just a little bit about advocacy and how foundations can do it? And, you know, you can't give legal advice, but talk about how you think about advocacy in this context and why it matters.
Let me validate your experience that folks go running for the hills when you start talking about advocacy. And it's changing. I have to say there's a movement within philanthropy to recognize that we can do things that actually seek to change systems, and we don't have to be quite so frightened about it. First, so all your listeners know, if they don't already, we're a private foundation. We are not legally allowed to engage in legislative advocacy and making or the electoral process. So there are things we can do, though, with supporting community-based organizations and the advocacy they're doing. We can then, once a bill is passed or once a program is being designed, we can support the kind of technical assistance, implementation to make that program work. And then we can support organizations in the community that are keeping government sort of honest to make sure that the programs as designed are actually being implemented. So it's not pure legislative advocacy, but it is supporting advocacy and then supporting the implementation of policies that result from the advocacy that's being done.
So advocacy is healthy. Consult your doctor. Your mileage may vary.
And call us. I should be careful because I might get a bunch of calls. I know you've got a big listenership.
Let's hope.
But I do, and I think it's a role philanthropy or philanthropic leaders can play, is explaining how a particular partnership, maybe a vehicle within a partnership, is fair game. Why we can do that as philanthropy. We are making an investment that can signal to other philanthropy that it is okay to do this. And I think the relationships that get built among philanthropic leaders also really help because we can kind of behind closed doors talk about what are you doing here? And that may be something my general counsel is not so keen on. Why should I be sort of more leaning into this than they might want me to do?
Can I jump in and just say, you know, especially in a time of a $38 billion deficit, we can look back to the several years of surplus that we had and all of the incredible policy wins that came out of that. We still have a lot of work to do on implementation. There are a lot of dollars out there that still need to be leveraged and have the impact that they were intended to have. And I think philanthropy can be a really incredible partner for the state in doing that without crossing any lines.
An example of that is philanthropy can fund consultants to provide technical assistance in the development and implementation of programs. And those are relatively small dollar investments. They can be either outside of the government apparatus, but useful to government. And then the programs, like, there's so much from our vantage point in all of these funding streams, there needs to be a workforce component. Sometimes I say climate change is also a jobs program. And workforce monies are now ending up in agencies that don't have a lot of expertise around workforce. I say this both at the state, but I'm seeing it also in sort of a bigger way at the federal level. And I think that's a place where, in particular, we can bring workforce expertise because these programs are all getting developed and frankly rushed. The advantage you all have in the administration here is you have a little more time than the feds have. And the money is coming so fast and furiously from the federal agencies that my fear is that the programs don't have sort of, they're not going to be designed well in the first place. One thing we can fund and we're trying to do nationally is creating some feedback loops so that community groups, as they try to draw down those funds, when it's not working for them, and in many cases there will be challenges, that feedback can go to the public officials who hopefully can make workarounds or adaptations to the programs. Problem is, you need to have some longevity. That's not going to happen in 12 months' time. I remember getting a call from someone in the federal government who said, we need to figure out how to engage community, and you guys in California figure that out. I was like, okay, well, here's some of the things you do. What's your time frame? He said, I got 3 months. It's like, well, okay, that's not going to really be community engagement. Let's just acknowledge that. So if you can't do it up front, how do you create a cycle where there's feedback that you're going to get the money out? Let's make sure that someone can feedback and say that's not working because of these various sort of aspects or constraints of the program.
Well, it sounds like another reason why these partnerships are so important, because foundations and their grantees already have these built-in feedback loops. They have relationships. And one would hope that you can have candid conversations about what doesn't work, because knowing what doesn't work is just as important as knowing what does work. And so how can you get candid information in these contexts so that you know what doesn't work without, frankly, holding certain organizations responsible for having done something that didn't work?
Or getting sued.
There's that. Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of uncomfortable conversations that we have to be willing to have. I think we get stuck in a dynamic of defensiveness, which I totally understand. And, you know, we are, as public servants, accountable to our constituents of the state of California, and not everyone's happy. And we need to be able to take that in a real way. So I do think the question for me is, okay, it's about being comfortable with uncomfortable conversations, but it's also about being solutions oriented. If we can sit down at a table and say, this history of extraction is wrong, it happened, we need to acknowledge that, now what? We can keep on talking about the history, or we can kind of translate that into what we're actually going to do about it. So those are the conversations I'm eager to have, particularly with philanthropy. But let's face it, philanthropy and the state are just two different ivory towers.
It's true.
So Don, a little earlier, you were talking about all this money coming in as a jobs bill, an equity opportunity. That is kind of, you're actually painting the narrative about what this work can look like and what the future can look like. Elena, can you talk a little bit about how that narrative affects your work and the communications that goes into that?
Yeah, I think the narrative is complicated because there are so many dynamics that feed into it. But if you can extract some of the common themes and stay focused on those, one of them for me, which may not be the sexiest thing to talk about, but capacity building and technical assistance for grassroots organizations, and I would argue small cities and local jurisdictions, to connect the dots there is really important. And we all mean different things when we talk about capacity building or technical assistance, even when we say things like equity. What are you actually saying there? So I think the communications is really important. On the narrative side specifically, I also think it's really important for communities to be heard and to have that translate into something concrete. So one example that I'm working on right now with the Tribal Affairs Secretary is a documentary project that's tracking the work of the Truth and Healing Council that was established by the governor in 2019 after a formal apology to California Native people. So we need to tell that story. And we actually do have to invest time and energy in telling that story in a respectful, non-extractive way. So I think it has kind of reached my role in a way that I want to advocate and partner with philanthropy on that storytelling and doing it in a way that amplifies the work of the community.
We can also provide funding for these sort of projects, which isn't necessarily coming out of a particular funding stream that is flexible enough at the state level to do it, perhaps. There's a similar effort amongst philanthropy to support a documentary process around the reparations task force and some of the, particularly the history, the accurate new telling of the real history of Californians and how African Americans were experienced, what they experienced in the history of California. And now they're trying to turn that, it was like a 500-page report,
yeah,
into size, kind of bite-sized chunks that are really accessible to folks more broadly than someone who's going to try to read a 500-page report. So I think that kind of communications is quite important. I mean, to also say from a foundation perspective, we have a bit of a megaphone, a bit of a sort of opportunity to amplify ideas.
Well, can you, in the last couple minutes that we have, how about a couple of examples? You've listed a number of them in your piece of where these partnerships work. What good thing happens as a result?
Well, one of the examples that Don briefly mentioned, I just want to dig into a little bit, is CME, the Community Economic Mobilization Initiative, with which the Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment, several other foundations have seeded. And in that case, we are getting applications from advocates. The Sierra Health Foundation runs this program, so they technically are getting applications from all across the state of community-based organizations to say, like, I need staff support to attend all of these local meetings. I need help with a grant writer. And we've already seen the impact of that. Even just, and it doesn't have to be big dollars. Sometimes that can be a relatively small financial investment that has huge payoff. We've also partnered on a High Road Training Fund to support the work of the High Road Training Projects. Basically, we have this amazing program, but in order for participants to be successful, they need help with childcare. They need help with transportation. These are things state dollars doesn't do well. So we have a lot of great examples and a lot brewing in the mix as we speak.
The High Road Training Partnerships was going to be, it was the first example that came to my mind. It's a really innovative approach to think about training at a sectoral level and to bring labor leaders together with employers, together with training groups and education providers to think about how to do training right to meet the needs, future workforce needs of that region with those employers in a collaborative way with labor. I hope I'm getting that.
Absolutely.
Now, so there was a pooled fund to help with the planning of HRTPs. And I think that's the acronym for High Road Training Partnerships. And that's a kind of role philanthropy can play. There's also ways we can support the training providers in those conversations so they can be ready to be at the table. It's not resources per se to be able to fund their time, to fund their capacity. And childcare is a great example of how we can help the training providers who are the grantees that we often support to be in those conversations. We also support the labor leaders and to help them come to the table as well. This is a really early stage effort, but we think there's a ton of promise in trying to create new places for real workforce development planning to happen.
Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have left, I would just ask each of you, if you had a magic wand and could wave it, what would the next couple of years look like? We'll start with you, Don.
Well, first, I would hope there's no budget deficit, but that actually is not in the cards. So California's gone from a position of great surplus to now a deficit. Good news is there was a lot of resources to be committed, and they were committed to one-time investments because of the nature of the kind of laws that govern California's budget. So I wish there were no deficit. That is what it is. I would also hope that the funding that's coming from the federal government, I would say, more so than the experience we're having with the state, comes at a slower pace that allows communities to get ready to really direct things. And what you want to see is investments in a community that are geared toward higher value jobs, that create opportunities on ramps to the middle class, that are accessible to folks who've historically been overlooked. And if the funds come faster, then the community can identify those priorities we're worried that the same old folks are going to end up benefiting from the investments that get made.
Elena, what does the beautiful future look like to you?
There's a couple of things. One, I think, is aligning different types of capital towards priorities that we share between the philanthropy and the state. So whether that's grant-making dollars, also investment dollars, impact investing, that's one of the, kind of the future states that I'm really excited about and feel like right now it's a bit siloed. Second is that the state and philanthropy does a better job kind of balancing each other out when it comes to appetite for risk and time spent strategizing. I would argue big generalization, philanthropy strategizes a lot. The state often doesn't strategize enough. And so I think if we reach some kind of equilibrium through our partnerships, but the biggest thing is to not wait for crisis for action. I know it's human nature when you're in a crisis, you want to do something. And I love that and appreciate that. And we certainly spread the word when there's a crisis. The earthquake in Humboldt last year, for example, spurs us to action. But when we think about public safety, natural disasters, immigration, you name the issue, it's generally a crisis that spurs us into action. I would love for us to feel that same sense of urgency towards building infrastructure and capacity and stability so that we can meet the crisis better prepared.
And I want to say kudos to you, because as we've come out of COVID and there were other crises that were compounding the problem with COVID, philanthropy engaged in emergency funding and rightfully did, along with the state. Now we're coming out of that phase and we have this unique window of opportunity. You've brought more focus and been able to engage less in the kind of crisis response and more in the longer term thinking about how we can create the California we all want to see and, frankly, restore the California dream, this time for everyone.
Well, folks, it's a love fest. It's delightful to see this kind of relationship happening.
We are very lucky.
Well, if there's governors out there who listen, I'm sure there are plenty. Do what California does. Don't hire Elena because she has a job. But the idea is begin to build these relationships, make friends in high, medium, and low places, because that's how we get things done. I really just can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Elena Chavez-Quesada, Senior Advisor for Social Innovation, the Officer of Gavin Newsom, and Don Howard, President and CEO of the Irvine Foundation. We are coming to you from the Irvine Foundation offices in downtown San Francisco. Please come visit San Francisco. Don't believe the haters. It's just great to have you, and thank you again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we're back.
Were there consequences?
So here is my take.
Uh-oh, here goes Kirk.
This conversation.
Kirk Brown cleared for takeoff.
Is the reason why our national conversation around politics is so insane.
Please tell more.
Here's the case. Here's the case I'm going to make. Listen to this conversation. Listen to how thoroughly Elena has thought this through. How thoroughly Elena knows how to navigate these partnerships, bring these people together. And the consequence of this is, think about the work that Don and Irvine and the other foundations coming behind can do. They can say, okay, got it, state of California. You can leverage billions to accomplish outcomes, but we can deliver millions and even less. We can deliver thousands and hundreds of thousands so that this implementation work that so often gets left by the wayside can be done and done more effectively. And we can create outcomes where there's real equity that happens, real communities that are left at the margins and are going to be brought to the fore. This is a threatening conversation. This conversation threatens the core of all the systemic stuff that we want to get cleaned up. And who needs to be at the lead of that? Who needs to help pilot that? Who needs to make sure that that's going to happen in an effective way? People like Elena and Don. It's so clear. So this is so exciting. It's so cool. I'm so glad they're talking about it. But the consequence of this, and Eric, this is your fault. And then I'll stop.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is your fault.
I apologize.
You said everybody in every other state, listen to what's being done here. Because this is another example of something that can roll out of California with extraordinarily positive impact in other parts of the country. And I think it's exactly right. So this is, Eric, I think this is one of the most consequential conversations we've ever had on this podcast, because this is creating real change today. There's billions of dollars behind it, but it's a model. It's a model that could remake economies everywhere. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're right. And we're done with this guy. I mean, like, what else is there to say? I think you're right. I've been thinking about this for a long time. Now, mind you, I had thought about it in different ways. I had been a press secretary for about half an hour in Washington on the Hill. And then when I went over onto the other side, I was thinking, huh, if we could do build better relationships between, actually, at the time it was nonprofits and members. But then when I went over into philanthropy, I thought, huh, foundations do all those things that Don was talking about. And governments have all that money. They can't. And Elena talked about the constraints on that money. And yeah. That is, it's like, whatever, hand in glove, come up with the metaphor of choice about how these two large institutions can work together. And they are starting to do this. And it has happened in fits and starts in lots of places. But most states don't have an Elena in place. And many foundations don't nearly have the bravery and the vision that Don has in understanding how these pieces fit together. And that was very exciting to me too when I read their piece, because it ought to be, as you say, a lesson for folks everywhere about how can we make these two pieces fit together and add up to a whole lot more than just the sum of their parts.
So can we talk about Elena specifically for a moment? Because this notion of being the senior advisor for social innovation, serving a governor, sitting in the governor's office, obviously California is an interesting state.
Big place, yes.
Fifth largest economy in the world. But Elena's, and obviously there have been other people in this role, though I thought that was an interesting back and forth about how this really is something that the Newsom administration has really made possible and made happen, and the values alignment between what's being put forward for this Office of Social Innovation with philanthropies across the state are working towards. But Elena's particular skill set, particular background, particular resume just feels so perfectly suited for this role. And as you were going through that conversation, I was thinking to myself, this is another great illustration of kind of the systemic work that needs to be done. You know, these big players, you know, federal funding, state funding, philanthropic funding, bringing it together for these better outcomes. But there's a real human element to it. And it seems like Elena is just the right person at the right time to pull these pieces together to create this, let's call it a tapestry, if you will, of just this change that's going to happen in all these positive ways across these different communities. It seems like, and I know you've worked with and been around Elena for a long time, but it really feels like this is an individual that's got a very unique and perfectly suited skill set for this work in this moment.
Well, yes. And the understanding about how nonprofits work and how foundations work and how government works is they're different muscles. There are different, as I had said, constraints and different opportunities. And being able to fit those together appropriately is essential. The other thing is Elena is willing to go out there. And when you work for an elected official, basically you go out into the field, you go out into the community, and people just yell at you because they have their expectations are at an 11. And yeah. Your capacity to meet those expectations are somewhere in the 2 to 3 zone. And yeah. So the difference there is frustration and anger and all that other stuff. And Don kind of noted about how Elena takes that all in when she goes to a meeting. But what she does, instead of getting defensive, is that she learns. And I also think that she is able to build trust within the nonprofit and the philanthropy community because she's one of them as well. And that kind of ability to really assess where the needs are, identify how to meet those needs using these various tools, and that is foundations who can test things and try stuff, and if it doesn't work, then you don't do it. But understanding when it does work, why it does work, and how you would use government money to, you know, help these things really fly, and the organizations, the nonprofits that are going to be implementing much of this work and how they function and how they use money and all that stuff, that kind of those kinds of skills and I don't know, they're very, very soft skills in a sense. You kind of really have to be able to read people they're rare, but they needn't be rare because I think there are a lot of, they're rare in that job, but I think there are a lot of folks out there who'd be great in that job in different places. And if you are working in a state that has a strong philanthropic community, many do, some don't, but some do, and a governor or a whatever, some kind of executive function that has money that is dedicated towards these kinds of programs or ideas or approaches, I do think that that is the opportunity for marriages that is most certainly underutilized right now.
Well, and there's real risk here. I mean, Elena talks about humility being a key aspect of partnership. And, you know, for somebody from the state of California to be talking about humility and to mean it authentically, I mean, well, California needs
your
to do
point,
something.
Kirk.
California gets something done. California and Elena can actually sit authentically in that place and say, you know, we're going to actually have authentic partnerships. And I really thought the rapport and the respect between Don and Elena was so obvious in this conversation, but it also made me think about Don. You know, here you're the president and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation. This work, this kind of partnership work, knitting these different pieces together, making the money work, you know, delivering funding for childcare and transportation to help make sure that people can get to meetings that they would otherwise be cut out of. That's not without its own kind of risks, right? And to actually have these different institutions kind of figure out a way to work together, you know, where we have the billions of dollars of federal and state dollars moving, but then we have millions or less than amounts of than that from foundations kind of helping try to guide that. That's not without its own kind of risk. And I thought, I love that way that Don was really engaging that conversation, but also was so clearly just deeply respectful of the way that Elena's pulling this all together and then creating spaces for the foundation to come forward with its own investments. And by the way, as Don points out, it created these incredible opportunities for leveraged wins, right? Very, very small dollars can create these huge outsized outcomes in this environment.
For sure. I would say I have two comments there. One is that on the foundation side, the risk is kind of, it's such a small R risk.
Hmm.
What's the risk that you're going to find out that a hypothesis that you had turned out not to be the case? Big deal. That's actually good. And we talk about this all the time. Learning what doesn't work is as important as learning what does work. And so if the foundation can incur that kind of so-called risk, but it's really just learning what doesn't work in a way that doesn't cause people to, whatever, not get voted back into office or that, or, and frankly, it doesn't encourage a government to spend a whole lot of money on something that has a low chance of success because they don't really have the luxury of testing in that same way. When you go in and sell a program, you kind of sell it on faith sometimes because mm-hmm. you just don't know that it's going to do what you think it's going to do. So I don't think there's that much risk. And then on the second point is that you can tell that Don is an incredible systems thinker.
Yeah.
He looks at these opportunities from a million angles. And he thinks to himself, okay, what are some of the variables that we have the potential or the capacity to have an influence on so that these much larger, these huge amounts of money can be used properly? And yeah, childcare at a meeting seems like who would think of that kind of stuff? But and my guess is also this comes from listening to grantees. Listening carefully to the community and other things, like actually knowing what people need, that requires, as you say, a humility, an ability to listen, an understanding about how systems work, and a willingness to do that stuff. And some of that stuff is very unsung, but who cares? The point is to get things done and to make a difference. And that's the one more thing I would say about Don. He is very outcomes oriented. He wants to know what good thing is going to happen as a result of this. And it shows.
I just wanted to cut up Elena's comments and just like odd quotes all over my office because what if this comment, Elena starts talking about, we get distracted by the big policy win, but then we don't focus on implementation. Could we please just repeat that again and again and again? It's not just the policy win. We have to implement. And this notion that billions of dollars are now flowing from these federal bills that were passed and now rolling through states and they're headed towards communities. And I just, every time and there's a time limit, this has got to be delivered so quickly. It just feels like these poor communities are being asked to step under Niagara Falls, not even being given an umbrella. It's a, you know, grab your thimble and see what you can catch from this just onrush. And it's so hard to get it right. So to see folks leaning into that conversation too and saying, you know, yeah, we've got some big wins. These are landmark pieces of legislation, but to make sure these dollars get delivered. And the pitch I'd make about risk, Eric, is that if we get this wrong, then our goals for equity, our goals for these outcomes are either delayed or they're simply missed again. And so to me, that's the risk. Like none of these folks want this crazy once in a generation opportunity to run by the wayside. And so, yes, there can be learning if we get it wrong, but there's a real opportunity here that's got some real timelines around it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And the other thing that we kind of alluded to in our conversation is this willingness of foundations to engage deeply with elected officials and with policy and legislation in ways that are legal and appropriate and you're allowed to do. But many grant letters will say you're not allowed to use this money to lobby, which hamstrings the grantee. The fact is, there are so many ways that a grantee can use foundation's money to lobby, and to tell them that they can't is incorrect. They can. They have all sorts of ways to do it. You can't direct them to use the money to lobby, but they can take their money. And, you know, there's also, I won't get into the legality of it. But the other thing is that the Irvine Foundation and other foundations like this are willing to have the conversations with legislators and with elected officials about what a better world looks like. And they're able to do the kind of grant making that helps get them there. And that's the sort of thing that many foundations shy away from for reasons that absolutely escape me. They are mystifying because this stuff is legal. It's okay. And it actually, if you want the so-called leverage, everyone is talking about leverage this and leverage that. If you want real leverage, you know, your $100,000 could unlock tens of millions of dollars of government spending if you get it right. Now that's actual leverage.
The fact that this kind of relationship building is kind of a new idea and it's only been happening within a certain, you know, time frame around the Newsom administration is incredible to think about, particularly in California, where there's such a wealth of philanthropy and resources to draw on. I will say, hearing Don talk about partnership and partnership being possible, again, I go back to this, you know, is this systemic or is this just Don's a super intelligent, thoughtful, the right person to help guide this stuff? Because, you know, this notion, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, Eric, given your experiences in philanthropy, partnership seems like such a great word, especially when it's other words are around it, like trust and relationship and vulnerability, you know, these partnerships that have all these aspects. And yet partnership is such a difficult thing to get right in a philanthropic context. Now you're talking about bringing in the state. So how difficult is this partnership thing really? Because it actually seems like it's extraordinarily difficult to do this kind of public-private thing around philanthropy and then leveraging state resources.
Well, I mean, for starters, you could play kind of words that sound good, philanthro-speak bingo, and go partnerships and trust and engagement and collaboration, and they'll say it and say it and say it and not mean it. Mm. Partners. You know, foundations talk about grantees as their partners, which is sometimes that's true. And sometimes they're our partners in, as long as they do what we tell them to do. So to actually be honest when you're talking about relationships and trust and partnerships, those things are based on time spent together. They're based on personal relationships. And Don and Elena go back and they were able to skip through a bunch of the muck in order to get to real outcomes, because I'm sure everyone wants Elena's ear and wants the governor to care about their issue and wants the government of California to spend money on their thing. And so Elena uses these relationships to cut to the chase, to understand who's really willing to do what it takes to be successful and who just wants a quick fix. And so those things take time. They are born out of real conversations and being able to admit when something doesn't go right and being candid about what you're good at and what you're not so good at. That's when you take all that philanthro jargon nonsense bingo and turn it into something meaningful and real. And I would just ask anybody who is talking about that stuff to show their work. And that's really important. And this is on both sides, but especially on the foundation side, because we can say whatever we want and no one's going to challenge us. But I say you got to go show your work. If you're talking about trust, then tell me why you're trustworthy. And if you're talking about collaboration, then prove that you're actually willing to do something that somebody else wants to do more than the thing that you want to do. And you're finding a way in the middle to be stronger together.
Well, and isn't that why this is so consequential? Because you listen to the way that Elena and Don talk about this. the evidence behind what they're doing. There's real impacts in the field. They're being transparent about it. They're writing about it. Don has had this as his personal priority to talk about this for the past 18 months, which I love. You know, he's committed to this as one of the things that from his office and his position he's got to talk about. But to me, this gets to the heart of why this is also so threatening, if you will, because equity is at the center of this. There's real outcomes being created to bring people in who have otherwise been being left out. And it's working. It's showing that you can actually do this. And so I think that's where this gets so disruptive and so threatening and so consequential. There's a whole bunch of other people that don't want our public sector to work on our behalf. They want to break that. They're working as hard as they can to break that. And this conversation is showing actually that it can work, and it can work quite well, and it can have real values that we all care about at the center of it. And I think that's just, it's an incredible conversation to listen in on.
Consequentialness. That's our middle name. Kurt.
So.
Uh-oh, you're going to wrap it up.
Let me test you on this one. Uh-oh. This is the last one. Let me test you on this one.
All right.
Is there a scary side of this conversation? So we love hearing this. We love hearing Don and Elena. We love hearing this connection because we share these values around equity. We are around positive change. If we heard this conversation from people who had different values, but they were mingling public and private dollars to create outsized outcomes that were headed the other direction in whatever way you want to talk about that, would we be concerned about that? And how would we express that concern?
Well, you could say the same thing about government or philanthropy anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think when people hold the purse strings who would like to continue the status quo or frankly make it worse, I mean, that happens every day. And I think there are probably not a few state houses in this country in which that is the case. Same thing for philanthropy. Philanthropy isn't good or bad as a mechanism. It's only good or bad with what you do with the mechanism. So, life is scary. It's scary enough as it is with all the, with the uphill battle that so much of this work is facing. So, but I love to see where we are able to combine these forces in such a consequential place, to use a quirky word, to make a difference.
You're right. So I guess you're right. The alternatives were, in some respects, we're just describing the status quo.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's Monday.
This is just disrupting that status quo, which again is why it's so exciting to hear about. Well, my goodness, Elena, all the best to you. Keep writing, keep doing this work. It's so exciting to see what's happening out of the Office of Social Innovation. And Mr. Howard, Don Howard and the Irvine Foundation, thank you for being partners in this and being willing to talk about it and take, I think, risks, but also deliver the outcomes we care about. Eric, that was such a cool conversation. I'm so glad we all got to listen in on it.
I just do these to make you happy, Kirk.
Are you coming around? 6 years in, are you coming around? This is a good idea.
I'll get back to you.
Well, that was awesome. So that was Elena Chavez Quesada from the Office of the Governor for the State of California, the Office of Social Innovation, and Don Howard, the President and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation. And Let's Hear It. Thank you so much. And Eric, thank you. And we will see you next time.
Thank you, Kirky. See you next time.
Okay, everybody. That's it for this episode. Please let us know if you have any thoughts about what you heard today or people we should have on this show. And that definitely includes yourself. And we'd like to thank
our indefatigable producer, Harper Brown.
John Ali, the tuneful and inspiring composer of our theme music.
Our sponsor, the Lumina Foundation.
And please check out Lumina's terrific podcast, Today's Students, Tomorrow's Talent. And you can find that at luminafoundation.org.
We certainly thank today's guest and, of course, all of you.
And most importantly, thank you, Mr. Brown.
Oh, no. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Okay, everybody. Until next time. Thank you.